You may be seated. Thank you. All right, this is the case of Henderson versus Green Valley Ranch, case number 74072. And at this time, we'll have both attorneys state their name for the record. And I will ask the appellant, do you request any rebuttal time?
I'm going to save a few minutes.
How many would you like?
Three.
Three? That would be the order. So just make sure you spell your name, too, for my clerk. Thank you. You may proceed. Whenever. Yes, you may proceed.
I am Mike Wood.
Oh. Come on up to council table.
Farm 462 for appellant Anna Henderson.
Whenever you'd proceed.
If it please the court, Chief Judge Silver, Judge Gibbons, Judge Tao, I represent Anna Henderson regarding her July 2013 industrial injury and ensuing workers' compensation claim. The claimant was a server at Green Valley Ranch and sustained a rather nasty fall, a full force fall onto her right side, causing multiple injuries. The injury occurred on July 28, 2013, and after some home self-help, finally resorted to medical care and visited the Concentra facility in August of 2013. It's interesting, on this very first visit, the Concentra medical personnel recognized a possible lateral meniscus tear of the claimant's right knee. It was about this time that the C4 form, the initial report of injury and claim for compensation, was filed. Ms. Henderson filled out the upper part of the document reporting injury to both knees, both ankles, the shoulder, right shoulder, the neck, and back. The acceptance letter, which issued about 30 days later, accepted the cervical, the right knee, ankle, shoulder, / strain, and right great toe contusion. The ankle and the toes have resolved themselves, not really problematic in this claim. The claimant was referred, and I presume this is by Concentra, to Dr. Detling, who ordered an MRI. After reviewing the MRI, it was Dr. Detling's opinion that she had some possible internal non-industrial problems, some bursitis or whatever, and declared the claimant was a maximum medical improvement. It was at this point that, regarding the treatment in the claim, the claimant picked up treatment on for her cervical spine condition through Dr. Fisher, so it wasn't until May 16 of 2014 that she was referred by the administrator to Dr. Stephen Thomas, a well-known orthopedist in town, who diagnosed internal derangement of the right knee and specifically thought she had a meniscus tear. Dr. Thomas, and I quoted it in my brief, gives an excellent explanation of how a meniscal tear can be present, but not picked up by an MRI because there's no fluid in the tear and they're in alignment. Looks like a perfectly fine meniscus, yet there is a tear, and that is what his clinical evaluation was. She had internal derangement, there were signs and symptoms of that, and he requested an arthroscopy to take a visual look in the knee to verify that there was a meniscal tear. The claimant at that point sought to visit outside the workers' comp arena and actually visited a doctor who was both on the panel for the administrator and her private insurance, and saw Dr. Yee, also an orthopedist, who also thought she had a meniscal tear of the right knee. The claimant was then referred to Dr. Faust, who thought there wasn't a tear and that no surgery was needed. She went back to Dr. Thomas to explore her options, and it was at this point where he explains how the meniscus tear can exist, even though the MRI is negative, referring to it as a false negative MRI. Dr. Thomas, again, diagnoses the meniscal tear, requests an arthroscopy. Instead of that, they send him a form letter asking if she's at maximum medical improvement. He is the treating physician in the case, and he says, no, she's not at maximum medical improvement and needs an arthroscopy. That's July 21st, 2014. Exactly a month later, August 21st, 2014, the administrator issues a closure notice of the entire claim. We're at a point where we've got some very definitive diagnoses regarding claimant's injuries, and the insurer, for whatever reason, has issued a closure notice. Perhaps they were relying on Dr. Faust, Dr. Detley, but the more credible reporting, I believe, was that of Drs. Thomas and Yee.
Well, I mean, credibility is not for us. Credibility is for the hearing officer, appeals officer. Right. And the only question for us is, was his or her decision supported by substantial evidence or not?
Right.
It's not whether we agree or disagree that this witness is more credible than any other witness.
And the appeals officer, before I got to the appeal stage, the claimant, and I don't blame her for doing this, she submitted to surgery by Dr. Yee.
Now, when she goes to Dr. Yee and she gets her arthroscope, presumably there's a camera in there and took pictures of her knee and a tear, right?
Well, it was an arthroscope / medial meniscectomy is what
right.
It was.
They usually take pictures. You can usually see a tear.
Yeah.
Did they do that and show it to the administrator?
He repaired the meniscus is what he did. But by this time, the case was closed. It was in the appeals process, first stage, which is the hearing officer.
But didn't his work put an end to the question of whether she actually had a tear?
He got a scope in there.
He confirmed it.
Right. If I would have been on the case, I would have rushed all that information to the administrator and said, hey, listen, we got a bad injury here. It was a tear. It's been repaired. Reopen the claim or rescind your closure notice, and let's proceed with the medical care as Dr. Yee has prescribed. That didn't happen. Instead, during the appeals process, the insurer, I believe, the administrator, referred the claimant to Dr. Sutherland, also a known knee guy in Las Vegas. He reviews the records, doesn't see her, but concludes that she sustained an injury to the knee, was a tear, and that the surgery was appropriate for her situation.
And he was the IME?
He was an IME doctor.
Right.
He was sponsored by and paid for by the insurer / administrator. The claim didn't resolve at that point. And it proceeded to the appeals level, where the appeals officer, finding medical question, refers the knee issue for a independent medical examination to an agreed party. I can't remember if we agreed to a party or he just picked one off the provider list that a managed care organization for the insurer administrator, which is York Risk Services for Management. Anna Henderson was referred to Dr. Bernard Ong, also a known knee guy, whose lengthy report is in the record, and I've highlighted the major aspects of it, which is, yes, she had an injury. This injury caused a meniscal injury, and the surgery was necessary and appropriate for her condition. Based on all that, the appeals officer said, yes, this injury caused this cartilage tear, and the cartilage tear was appropriately repaired surgically, and the closure was totally inappropriate when it was issued in August of 2014.
Well, how do you allege that the appeals officer abused his discretion by not expanding your client's claim to include her lumbar spine? What evidence can you point to show that there's an abuse of discretion?
Well, this was actually an off-the-record colloquy at the end of the last hearing when I said, Dr. Ong is a knee joint guy, a shoulder guy. He's not a spinal surgeon. We need someone to look at the back also. He just kind of shrugged and issued the decision letter, which I complied with. The claimant continued her medical care on the low back. And you can see Dr. Helmy's records specifically.
That was after the appeals officer.
That was while it was being appealed and contested through the hearing level and the appeals level. Her first visit with Dr. Helmy was...
you have this private conversation, but why didn't you, at least make an effort to put this in writing, make a motion, to go through the channels? Because private conversations don't actually count for very much.
No, and I had my reasons for not pursuing that aren't really relevant right here. But suffice it to say that the appeals officer never followed up on my concerns. So that isn't in the record. So, but immediately after, not immediately, but after closure of the claim, the claimant did resume medical care with Dr. Helmy, who relates the low back condition to her industrial injury. And, not only just the low back injury, there ended up being diagnoses of L5-S1 radiculopathy. She underwent injection, both pinpoint and steroid injections under fluoroscopy for what should have been the responsibility of the industrial insurer. So the referral, we don't often see the referral to physicians to decide what should be in the claim or not.
You're right at 3 minutes. Did you want to continue or did you want
to? Let me finish this line of thought real quick. She was referred to Dr. Basowitz. She said, my chief complaints, my neck and my back. Dr. Basowitz evaluated the back, or the neck, excuse me, referred her back to the physiatrist for continued care, but said nothing about the low back. There was just a void where he should have discussed her signs and symptoms, and he did not do that. Typically what happens after, let's say, they'd approved a surgery for a knee, then we would have followed up on other affected body parts, and they would have been the subject of a determination or a hearing before the hearing officer or hearing before the appeals officer. I've got just a couple of minutes left, so
thank you.
I'll reserve those minutes.
Good morning.
John Lavery, LAVERY, Lewis, Brisbois, Viscard, and Smith for the respondents. Oh, I'm sorry. I heard somebody speak. I thought it was you. I apologize. To answer a couple of questions, one, you're right. We're not here to relitigate the facts. Dr. Basowitz did, in fact, issue an opinion. He said that she had degenerative disc disease in her back and she was not a surgical candidate and referred her off to physiatry. That's certainly his prerogative. the Nevada legislature, the Nevada Supreme Court, it's NRS 616C160, that says if you're going to expand the scope of the claim to include a newly developed condition or one that was not initially listed on the C4 form. And while I'm on that thought, I'm going to back up for just a second, because in the pleadings, the petitioner cast aspersions, to put it politely, at my client and insurance administrators in general, saying, well, they make these determinations without really knowing what the full scope of the claim is. Well, that's not how the process works. It's NRS 616C065. It says that an insurance administrator has 30 days from the time that a C4 form, a C4 form is a seminal document in the work comp case. It's a notice of injury or claim for compensation. The physician fills out the top portion, or the claimant fills out the top portion of it, the physician fills out the bottom of it, and as part of that form, he lists the diagnoses. Now, usually there's a narrative report that goes along with the C4 form, but the C4 form is a seminal document that starts this process off. Whether something is raised as possibly existing is not sufficient. It's my case out of the Supreme Court from about 25, 30 years ago. It's a United Exposition Services versus SIS that says that a doctor has to state to a reasonable degree of medical probability that a condition is compensable, or there has to be sufficient facts for the appeals officer, once an appeals officer looks at it, to come to that conclusion. An insurance administrator can't do that. So they have to take the diagnosis, and they have to, by statute, issue a determination limiting the scope of the claim to whatever it is they're going to accept within that 30-day window of time. Now, we come in later and we say, well, we want to expand the scope of the claim to include these other conditions. Well, the Nevada legislature has made two provisions for that. The first is NRS 616C160 that says a late manifesting or newly developed condition is not considered part of the claim unless the physician states to a reasonable degree of medical probability that the condition should be part of the claim. So going back, I think, to Judge Tao's question of did Dr. Bassowitz ever say this is part of the claim? No, he did not. The statement was made to you, well, Dr. Bassowitz has this opinion, or didn't render an opinion. Yes, he did. He said that she had degenerative disc disease in her back, which brings me to the second part, or the second section that the Nevada legislature has put together. It's NRS 616C175 that says the aggravation, precipitation, or acceleration of a pre-existing condition shall not be deemed part of a claim unless the physician states to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And there's actually a burden shift under 175, that once somebody says there is in fact this aggravation, the burden then comes back to me as the bad guy, as the defense, to say I have to prove that the industrial injury is not the primary cause of the condition. Well, in this case, you don't have an opinion anywhere in this record saying that there was an aggravation, precipitation, or acceleration of anything, nor do you have anybody saying that to a reasonable degree of medical probability, the findings that I have with respect to the lumbar spine are in fact attributable to the industrial injury. So whichever one of those you want to try and apply, depending on which part of the anatomy you're looking at the time, you don't meet the necessary threshold to add those as compensable components of the claim. Judge Tao also asked the question of, well, you had this, supposedly had this off-the-record discussion, why isn't it part of the record? Well, it should have been part of the record if you thought that somehow something wasn't being done. I mean, I didn't write the appeals officer's decision, Mr. Wood did. But if you disagree with what the appeals officer has said, you go back to the appeals officer and you file a motion for reconsideration, or you file a motion for rehearing, or you do something to say, wait a minute, you haven't addressed everything that I want to have addressed as part of this claim. You don't throw your hands up, walk away, and then file a cross petition for judicial review after I filed my petition that was untimely, and the district court said it's untimely, you can't do it.
Well, assuming it was timely, why would you say the appeals officer did not abuse his discretion by excluding Henderson's lumbar claim? Let's just assume it's timely.
Because you made the statement yourself, because nobody said that it belonged as part of the claim.
So, because it was off the record.
If it's not part of the record, it's not part of the record. It doesn't exist. I mean, you know, I can stand here and say whatever I want to say. If it's not part of the record, I don't know how else to phrase it. It's simply not part of the record. The appeals officer is bound by, you still have the necessary legal medical threshold to establish, either under 160 or 175, and by that I mean NRS 616C-160 or NRS 616C-175, I throw those things out because we use them all the time. But you still have those thresholds that you must meet in order to expand the scope of the claim to include a condition that was not originally part of the claim, and it was not. With respect to the knee condition, understand that in October the 3rd of 2014, to be exact.
Just to clarify, so is your argument so far all related to the lumbar claim? We're not talking about the knee.
I'm just addressing that as one of the issues that
right.
has been
okay.
raised.
Okay, so now we're going to switch gears to the knee.
To the knee, right. Because on October the 3rd of 2014, this was prior to Mr. Wood's involvement in this claim, my client issued a determination, and as you can see, you had a number of different physicians. Half of them saying there's no meniscal tear here, we don't see it, she's not a surgical candidate, no. You have the other half, admittedly, candidly, that's why we have courts.
And usually you're here saying go with the appeals officer. When it's between these two people, it's up to the appeals officer, and you have the district court order saying there was insufficient evidence to the appeals officer, yet you have some of the best surgeons in town saying she had a meniscus tear.
You have some of the other best surgeons in town.
But isn't that the appeals officer's decision? Where does Judge Levitt come in and step in and substitute her judgment for the appeals officer?
She did, because if you go back and look at the record in October of 2014, my client issued a determination saying the scope of the claim is limited to a strain, the surgery is not approved as part of the claim, and it was appealed. And then it was dismissed. The issue barred. And that's the argument that I made in front of one of many arguments that I made in front of
what the order reads is there's insufficient evidence to support the appeals officer's decision. That's the written order. The written order says insufficient evidence despite all of the doctors saying that she had a meniscus tear.
Well, all of the doctors didn't say that, and by
or
the
not all.
And by
at
and
least
by
their
the,
doctors.
Right, but by the time the determination was made, the surgery had already been done on a non-industrial basis. But at the same time, the issue had been raised now twice, once by the original determination.
So somebody who's injured, arguably injured, mm-hmm. has to wait around years for a determination before they can have surgery.
No, they don't have to wait for years.
Because clearly that's not what she wanted to do here. But that's going to preclude her.
She has every right to go do whatever it is she wants to do. But if you look at NAC 616C-126 and 129, the Nevada legislature has specifically laid out, she can go have a leg cut off if she wants to. That's certainly her prerogative. She can go do whatever it is she wants to do. It's a question of what becomes my obligation to treat, what it becomes my obligation to pay for, because you've decided that you want to go have surgery, because you've decided that you believe that this physician is right as opposed to that physician. Unless it's an emergency, and that's what NAC 616C-126 and 129 say, there are certain circumstances under which, if you're laying on the ground and it's a medical emergency, it becomes my responsibility, assuming that the provider goes and asks for the requisite approval, even after the care is provided. They still have to come and say, look, this was an emergency. We needed to treat this person. We expect you to pay for it. But at the end of the day, the claimant is perfectly free to go do whatever it is she wants to do. The question is, whose responsibility is it? Why is it my obligation because she's treating with a provider acknowledged outside the medical provider panel, which is contrary to statute. She's having care, which is in litigation at the time. You know what? I'm not going to bother with the litigation. I'm just going to go do what I want, and guess what? You're stuck with it. That's not how the process was designed to work. That's not what the legislature has said. If you believe, if anybody believes, that I should be responsible for those things, then go to the legislature and have them change what the statutes say. The statute makes no provision for what's being asked for. And in fact, again, was that me?
You have 5 minutes.
Okay. At the same time, there was a determination saying we are continuing to limit the scope of the claim to this condition and we're not authorizing the surgery. That was specifically challenged. It was appealed. It was taken to the hearing officer. The hearing, we, the parties at that time, it wasn't Mr. Wood, in fairness to him, it was not Mr. Wood. There's a process that you can basically skip the hearing office and go straight to the appeals office. So that's what we did. The claimant then voluntarily dismissed her appeal, saying, I don't want to challenge that. I'm not challenging the scope of my claim with respect to my knee any further, and I'm not challenging the fact that you're not providing me surgery to. So to answer your question with respect to are we waiting for years, maybe in some circumstances you might, but you're in the litigation process and you voluntarily chose to walk away from it. That's an abuse of discretion, and it's, one, it's res judicata, but it's an abuse of discretion to then turn around as an appeals officer and say, well, you're still obligated to do these things, despite the fact that she stepped outside the industrial context, and there's no dispute about that. Go and have treatment that clearly you've got a handful of doctors on one side saying one thing and a handful of doctors on the other side saying something else. The whole point of the process is to resolve that dispute.
But your order, and you provided this order to the district court.
Sure, I was under
your order says there's insufficient evidence to support the appeals officer's decision, not the argument that you're making right now.
That was part of the argument that I made to the district court.
But her ruling and her order only says, and that's an order that you submitted,
yes,
only mentions based on insufficient evidence.
That was the order I was instructed to provide. So that's the order that I provided, that there's insufficient evidence to support the appeals officer's decision.
Well, that's what she signed.
Right, and I can't take that back. I can't change that either.
How could the appeals officer, though, have made this same mistake? I mean, Judge Leavitt has a thousand cases to deal with. The appeals officer deals with these specific statutes all the time. So how could this mistake be made?
I'm not sure that I'm following your question. I mean,
if the appeals officer should have said, oh, you dismissed your appeal. You didn't go through the emergency process. You walked away. You didn't reopen this. I feel sorry for you. You've proven that it was a tear. The doctor that opened you up saw it. We know it's true. But too bad. You didn't go through the correct process.
Right.
That's essentially your argument.
I think he was wrong, and that's why I took my petition to the district court. That's
right, but how did that happen at the appeals level if it was so clear under the law?
I can't. Yeah. You're asking me to explain why.
Was that argued to the appeals officer?
Absolutely it was. Absolutely it was. Yes.
And this appeal officer used to be in insurance. I mean, it's
yes.
Gary Pulliam. He worked for insurance companies forever.
Correct.
He was an insurance guy. I know.
I have politely and tried to impress it, and he's no longer an appeals officer, but I used to impress upon Mr. Pulliam that I felt like he was a bleeding heart. So I'll say that on the record in front of all three of you.
But is there some motivation to get these claims closed? Because maybe the injured person will screw up on how they procedurally pursue it, even though they were injured. You just deny them, and that way hope they make a mistake later on so you won't have to pay for it.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And quite to the contrary. Again, look at what we're dealing with. You've got a handful of doctors saying yes, and you got a handful of doctors saying no. Which one's right? To say that we're just arbitrarily making a determination.
That's why I went to the independent
officer.
Why this process is set up the way it is.
Right. And that's why the appeals officer said, let's have the independent doctor look at it.
And even when we got to that point, even after we had all of these doctors, and it's so crystal clear that this is the way it is, the appeals officer didn't go, yeah, it's crystal clear. I believe these guys who say yes. He said, you know what, I've still got a medical question because I got a handful of guys over here saying one thing and a handful of guys over here saying something differently.
And your IME still said there was a tear.
Correct.
And so how was the appeals officer wrong when he had a handful, went and got an IME? IME says there's a tear, and you have a district court order saying there's insufficient evidence. And so the judge granted the petition.
Right, and I believe he was wrong in doing so for the reasons that I've stated, which is why I took the petition in the first place, and Judge Levin agreed with me. So,
isn't she just substituting her judgment for that of the appeals officer, which is contrary to the statutes?
No, if that were the case, she would have said, no, I don't believe Dr. X, I believe Dr. Y, and here's the conclusion. No, I don't accept that premise at all. But again, issues of jurisdiction are mandatory and non-discretionary. It's SIS versus Partlow-Hirsch. The Supreme Court has spoken on that as a long-standing principle. And when that appeal was dismissed, it's gone.
Thank you. But, well, go ahead and finish your thought.
Oh, no, that's fine. I wasn't sure where I was in the process.
Yeah.
I just looked at it and realized I was in the wrong direction. So unless one of the three of you has another question for me.
Do you have any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Firstly, the appeal and subsequent dismissal that he's referring to was of a request for a diagnostic arthroscopy. I discussed that in my reply brief, where Dr. Thomas said we need an arthroscopy. It was denied, it was appealed, the hearing level was bypassed, went to the appeals level, for whatever reason it was dismissed by Henderson's former attorneys. So, but that wasn't a request for a meniscectomy repair. It was a request for a diagnostic study. So it has no bearing on future happenings in the case, which were, you know, we have Dr. Thomas, Dr. Yee, and Dr. Sutherland all saying, this is related. I mean, they're almost saying this isn't even a close call. And then they close the claim and expect her to wait 4 or 5 years limping around with the torn meniscus. It's a very painful situation. So if I had been on the case at that time, I would have said, yeah, do what you need to get better. You don't need to suffer all this time waiting for what may be an eternity, which has turned out to be about 5 years now. So the barring argument that Mr. Langley speaks to does not apply to this case. And it was Officer Gilliam's right to say, I believe Thomas, I believe Yee, I believe Ong, and I believe Sutherland, and Fowles and Detling not persuasive. That was his job, and he said, yes, this is all related. And he had jurisdiction to say, because it was related, she had the right to proceed with surgery.
Thank you very much. Is there anything further than from the
no.
judges? No. Thank you very much, both sides, for your argument. This case will stand submitted. And I just wanted to also take the opportunity to thank all of our staff. Our Court of Appeals staff is here. And if you didn't know it, you are privy to the very last argument for the inaugural Court of Appeals. This will be our last time together, sadly, and but I think it is a special occasion, and I did want to again thank everybody here and thank the attorneys for their excellent job in their pleadings and their argument today, and thank them for being here. So does anybody else have anything further?
Yes, Chief Judge Silver didn't say it, but she was elected to the Supreme Court, so she'll be leaving at the beginning of January. And 4 years, it's been 4 years, that's hard to believe we've been together that long.
4 years, on and the same panel.
So it's been an amazing 4 years, and we're sure going to miss you, Judge
Silver. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's been an honor and a privilege to be on this court, and to say that I got to partake in the inaugural Court of Appeals, it's been very special. And so I just wanted to say a couple words before we recess.
I think we all should get certificates.
I do too. I do too. I'm going to make sure everybody gets one. And it will be in the form of an order and an opinion. That's how we're going to do that. So thank you again. And thanks for being here. So there you go. We'll be off the record.